Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series on understanding repair and recovery after traumatic spinal cord injury with Dr. Benjamin Greenberg, Associate Professor of Neurology at UT Southwestern, and Dr. Michael Levy, Assistant Professor of Neurology at Johns Hopkins University. My name is Roberta Peche, and I'm the Research and Project Manager of the Transverse Myelitis Association. Hosting today will be Chitra Krishnan, Executive Director of the TMA. Chitra, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about the TMA?
Sure. Thank you, Roberta. The TMA is a nonprofit that supports and advocates for people with rare neuroimmune diseases. These include transverse myelitis, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, also known as ADEM, neuromyelitis optica NMO, and optic neuritis. We support research and education programs to increase awareness, to improve our understanding of these diseases, and our goal is to develop new therapies to help individuals living with these illnesses.
Thank you, Chitra. A few housekeeping pieces before we get started. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. And also during the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com/myelitis.
Great. Thank you. I would like to now turn it over to Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Levy to introduce themselves. Dr. Greenberg, would you like to start?
Sure. Chitra and Michael and audience, it's great to be here today. My name is Ben Greenberg. I'm an associate professor of neurology at the University of Texas Southwestern in both the departments of neurology and pediatrics, and direct our clinics in transverse myelitis and neuromyelitis optica. Been a longtime member of the TMA and am looking forward to a great conversation today.
Dr. Levy?
My name is Michael Levy. I'm a neurologist at Johns Hopkins. I did my training here in transverse myelitis, and my clinical interest is in NMO and TM, as well as optic neuritis, and I also have a strong research interest in these areas.
Great. Thank you both for giving us your time and sharing your experience with our listeners. We've received about 60 questions and still coming in. Thank you to our community for sending them in. We will do our best to address these in the 45 minutes we have, and if we are not able to get through them today, we will organize a second podcast. So let's get started. The first question, which a lot of people asked, and it's generally sort of is in the range of exercise and physical therapy. So we all hear that these two are very key to repair and recovery after an autoimmune attack in these diseases. Dr. Greenberg, can you share with us what is the science behind this? Why is exercise and physical therapy so important?
Sure. It's a great question because it actually is a critical issue for our patients and our clinicians. So there's some things that have science behind it and some where we're looking for more. Physical therapy, structured physical therapy, does several things for a person after their spinal cord or brain has been attacked by an autoimmune disease. The first is it helps the body know that it needs to repair. If you're having difficulty walking and you decide just not to walk, your body really doesn't have an interest in spontaneously repairing damage that's been done. And what we have also learned is that people can learn to walk or run again incorrectly. They can develop habits in terms of their gait that actually lead to more energy being expended and them having more fatigue or hip or knee or ankle problems and requiring visits to an orthopedist. And so being trained to walk correctly is extremely important for the long-term health of an individual. What the science tells us is there's two benefits from the physical therapy. One is general health. Being more active leads to better bone density, better muscle mass, more energy, better cardiovascular fitness. But we also have some science to say that it helps with the recovery, that if you get instruction from a qualified therapist on how to walk again and do it correctly, that people who do that for longer periods of time do better in the long run. That's where we want science to catch up more and help quantify those impacts, because we all have to justify these requests to insurance and other people, and we want to be able to back them up. But what we're seeing in the trenches and what's been published says that physical therapy is critical to having as complete as possible long-term recovery from these events.
Right, thank you. This is a question from Linda in California, and I wonder if you can help take this one, Dr. Michael Levy. She was diagnosed with TM 21 months ago, was paralyzed from the chest down, and is walking fine now, but she's left with numbness, burning in her legs and feet. She and many others have asked, what is a productive workout routine to stay strong but not exacerbate pain or impede progress? What is the balance one should achieve with physical therapy and exercise that allows for repair but does not make symptoms worse, like increased tingling, increased pain?
Linda, that's a good question. Part of this echoes what Dr. Greenberg just said about not having a lot of data to support what we suggest, but having a lot of experience. And what our experience tells us is that as much as you can handle is the best amount of exercise. If you start to feel symptoms like pain and tingling, then you should stop. You should allow yourself some time to recover. And then if you can, you should continue, and hopefully over time, you'll be able to exercise more and more. In some patients, we do recommend treatment for the pain or for the discomfort associated with tingling to allow any measure of exercise, and that's fine. Whatever it takes to get you into the physical therapy program, we can do.
So Dr. Greenberg, you touched on this, that you said something about recovery can continue for a long time afterwards. So if someone is 18 months out, 2 years out, 3 years out, should they still continue physical therapy, or is there a certain window where you can have the maximum benefit?
Yeah, it's a great question. We get asked about windows of recovery all the time. And so first, what people need to understand is there is no door that closes relative to recovery. They will read online that at 3 months or 6 months or a year, whatever you've recovered is what you're going to recover, and it turns out to be factually incorrect. The body is able to improve function, recover function, many years after an initial event. I got reminded of this the other day in clinic when seeing a young woman who had her transverse myelitis as a young child and had been in a wheelchair, unable to move her legs for close to 10 years, and for reasons we don't understand, she started moving her feet and now her legs over the last year. And so there are huge potentials for recovery long after the event. What does help is intensive training as early as possible for as long as possible, because it's about repetition. It's about being exposed to doing things the right way to try and push your body to repair or compensate for damage in such a way that brings back function. And I also like to remind folks that using physical therapy as a tool to repair doesn't mean just going to a physical therapist and having a session a week or a couple sessions a week. Physical therapy is supposed to be an interaction between a patient and a professional to be told what should they be doing every single day at home. And the visits with the therapist are there to ensure you're doing it correctly. Sitting in a physical therapy office 30 minutes or an hour at a time, 1 to 5 times a week, will not lead to all the recovery a person can have. It should be the instruction guide for what you should do at home, and that has the distinct potential for long-term recovery, even if you're a year, 2, 3 years out from your event. A rigorous routine relative to physical therapy can make a big difference.
That's great. This is a question from Ellie in Melbourne, Australia. She says, why has my core temperature been lower following acute transverse myelitis, and why does my motor function diminish when my temperature goes up?
I can jump in on that one, and then Mike, you as well, just because I think this is a really fun topic because we see it so often. There is definitely a association between people's body temperature and their function in both directions. And over 100 years ago, a physician named Uthoff described Uthoff's phenomenon, which was when a patient who's had demyelination, damage to the insulation around their wires, recovers function. They do it for a lot of different reasons. They do it from repair, they do it from compensation, but that repair isn't as good as the original structure, and a person's body is left susceptible to the environment we're in, most notably temperature. So as a person's core body temperature goes up, the signals don't make it from point A to point B as quickly or robustly as they used to, and so symptoms can become more pronounced. So if you had a numb leg, that got better and it wasn't as numb, and then you find as you're running the leg goes numb again, that is Uthoff's phenomenon. It is not dangerous. It doesn't do any damage, but it's the transient reappearance of symptoms as a core body temperature goes up. In our multiple sclerosis patients who have demyelination throughout their body, what we've seen in our clinic is their body auto-regulates and resets their baseline core body temperature to a lower degree. Most humans, the average normal temperature is 98.6. In our clinic, it's 97.6. And I think it's a protective action that the body takes to try and keep functioning in peak performance. I don't know, Mike, if you see similar things in your population or not.
Yeah, we do. So with our transverse myelitis patients, we often see symptoms related to dysfunction of body temperature, heart rate, blood pressure, because a lot of those regulating signals come from the brain. They go to the organs through the spinal cord, and they can be affected as well. We had one patient who would sweat all the time until his transverse myelitis recovered, and that's partly due to spinal cord function. So, yeah, we've seen all kinds of fluctuations in body temperature as well as heart rate and blood pressure from TM.
So, you know, when you're talking so much about exercise and physical therapy, we just got this comment on Facebook from Sarah who said, my doctor wouldn't even order PT even though I asked for it over and over again. What does one do in such a situation?
Well, so one question would be, you know, why not? It doesn't really hurt to order physical therapy. You don't really need a doctor's order to get physical therapy, but you may need it to get insurance coverage for it. There are also a lot of exercises you could do online. You can also try to get a personal trainer to help make sure you're not exercising incorrectly. But I guess my first question would be to just have an honest conversation with the doctor about why not.
Great, thank you. So changing gears slightly, moving from exercise to recurrence, which is another question we get asked a lot, and a lot of people mentioned this in our Google Moderator group as well. So when repair is occurring, why does recurrence happen? What is the percentage of recurrence, and how do you detect it? What are the signs of a potential relapse?
Well, depending on the cause of transverse myelitis dictates the prevalence of recurrence. So in general, if somebody has transverse myelitis secondary to a condition such as neuromyelitis optica or secondary to multiple sclerosis, we are quite concerned about recurrences because the frequency is quite high. If somebody has had an appropriate workup and those underlying causes have been ruled out as much as possible, and there are others, so an appropriate workup requires a lot of different tests. If we've wind up diagnosing someone with idiopathic transverse myelitis, meaning we can't find a cause after a thorough workup, thankfully the recurrence rates are quite low. When patients have a recurrence of symptoms, we have to differentiate between a recurrence of inflammation causing damage versus a symptomatic event unrelated to damage, the so-called Uthoff phenomenon, that maybe there's a body temperature issue or a urinary tract infection, something that's giving the patient symptoms, but when we look, there's no recurrence of inflammation. For the individuals who truly have recurrence of damage happening to the spinal cord, we always keep an open mind. Did we get the diagnosis correctly? Could we be missing a problem of blood flow to the spinal cord? Could we be missing another cause of inflammation to the spinal cord? Because it is so rare. And so usually if people are having recurrences of inflammation, it prompts us to look for an underlying explanation because they would no longer fit into the category of, at least in my mind, idiopathic transverse myelitis. It means there's something more systemic going on.
Great, thank you. And so this would also mean when someone gets a flu or tonsillitis, when they feel their symptoms get worse, it may not necessarily be a setback. It may not necessarily be a recurrent attack.
Absolutely. That falls into that category of Uthoff's. The list of things that can cause a reemergence of old symptoms is extremely large. It includes heat, so your body temperature going up. It includes an infection somewhere like flu or tonsillitis or urinary tract infection. It includes a poor night's sleep. I'll see patients who have much more symptoms after a bad night's sleep versus well-rested. We see people who change their diet for better or worse, and it causes their symptoms to get better or worse. And so the emergence, or I should say the intensification of former symptoms, is rarely a recurrence. If anyone ever has symptoms lasting 24 hours or more, it definitely deserves a conversation with their physician to help sort out, are they suffering from new inflammation or some other cause?
Great, thank you. And the next set of questions is really about vaccinations. We get these asked all the time, and I would love both your opinions. So maybe we can start with you, Dr. Levy. What is your opinion about being vaccinated, and what is sort of a time frame after which vaccination is okay? I mean, is there a time frame?
Yeah, this is a question that we are trying to actively collect data on so that we can make informed expert opinions on. But right now, the way we think about vaccination is that it's a balance between protecting against an infection and actively activating the immune system with the vaccine and risking a recurrence. So in patients who are prone to having a second attack of TM or another attack of optic neuritis, activating the immune system with a vaccine can, although the risk is small, can sort of trigger a new attack. But we balance that against the risk of triggering an attack from an infection, which is a lot higher. So on balance, for patients who have recurrent disease, we still generally recommend vaccinations for everything except shingles and the nasal spray for the flu. For patients with idiopathic TM who've only had TM once, their workup suggests that they don't have a recurrent disease and they've never been they never required treatment to prevent another relapse, then for those idiopathic TM patients, we generally think of vaccinations as safe.
Dr. Greenberg, your thoughts?
So the issue of vaccinations, obviously, in transverse myelitis and other autoimmune diseases have been a big controversy for some time. My experience has been, and I think what the data supports, is that overwhelmingly vaccination is safe, that the risks are extremely small, and that the benefits far outweigh the risks. And in general, there are some patients where we may have slightly different recommendations. In general, we indicate that vaccines should be taken according to the guidelines, and that the risk of developing a serious flu or meningitis or pneumococcal infection, what we vaccinate for, are far worse than the risk of the vaccine. So we recommend people stay up to date on their vaccinations. One of the things we have to remember about idiopathic transverse myelitis is it was a perfect storm. There was probably, usually more often than not, at least I think there's an infectious trigger. We're still trying to prove it. And you had to have the right trigger and the right state of mind from an immune system point of view, all at the exact right moment in time for things to go wrong and cause the transverse myelitis. And the likelihood of that happening again, even in the face of vaccination, is extremely small, thankfully. And so we overwhelmingly support the use of them. And in terms of time frame, in general, really it's a matter of how people are feeling and their recovery. I don't think there is a immunologic wait period. If people are being treated with steroids or other immunosuppressants in general, we say wait till you're off before starting vaccinations. But it's a very case-by-case basis.
And I do have to thank you both for sort of addressing this question on vaccination. It's something that everybody is afraid of, and they ask us this question. And it's great that you're doing a study, Dr. Levy, and hopefully we'll have some more conclusive evidence that will be helpful to our patients. The next set of questions is on NMO. So I'll start with you on this one, Dr. Levy. Sam from Chapel Hill in North Carolina wants to know more about Rituxan in preventing new attacks in NMO. And are there any other new drugs in the horizon?
Rituxan is my favorite drug for preventing attacks in NMO because in our study looking back, we found that it was the most effective in preventing attacks. And it was effective in 80 to 90% of our patients in even preventing a single additional attack. It's a medication that's given on average about 4 times a year intravenously. It attacks one single part of your immune system and removes it from your blood so that it's unable to participate in the immune process and thereby reduces the risk of relapse from NMO. There are risks associated with this medication, just like with any, but they're even fewer than the other medications we use for NMO. And the new drugs on the horizon have a lot of potential, just like Rituxan, to be effective in patients who fail Rituxan or who have other issues that they can't be on Rituxan for whatever reason. And there are several clinical trials now that are in development for these drugs. And they target different parts of the immune system. And just from preliminary studies, small case series in humans and in animal studies, they look very promising.
Great, thank you. Nancy from Tennessee was diagnosed with NMO in 2004, and she wants clarification on brain involvement as NMO progresses. So she's been told no, but she refers to a paper by Dr. Pittock. I think it was a March 2006 paper in brain abnormalities in NMO, and she wants you to comment on, you know, is there brain involvement and can the disease progress without clinical attacks per se? Dr. Greenberg, do you want to start this one?
Sure. It's a very good question, and what I'd say to Nancy was the data is extremely clear that it is very common for NMO patients to have abnormalities on brain MRI. So we know now that having a normal brain MRI is no longer a requirement for being diagnosed with neuromyelitis optica. Now, there are different levels of brain involvement, and I've seen patients who have brain changes that are quite robust, and we always try to make sure we're not missing another explanation, so we have to keep open minds. But the mere presence of brain abnormalities on an MRI does not take away the diagnosis of neuromyelitis optica. Now, can the disease progress without attacks is a different issue. The research so far says overwhelmingly in general no, that we don't see a progressive or degenerative state within neuromyelitis optica. We see it quite frequently in multiple sclerosis, but is extremely rare. And there have been a couple reports, and I think all of the clinicians who are involved in NMO, Mike and myself and Dr. Pittock and others, have seen maybe one or two cases where we question progression, but we also have to be careful that people's symptoms can progress for a lot of different reasons other than ongoing disease activity. So in general, I tell my NMO patients that I don't worry about progression. I worry about attacks, and that even if the brain MRI is abnormal, that it doesn't deter me from the diagnosis.
And is there any relation between the hearing loss and NMO?
I am unaware of any literature, and I'll ask Mike to chime in on this one too, showing that hearing loss is a common or frequent symptom of NMO. It's not something I've experienced frequently in my NMO patient population. There are a couple of other autoimmune conditions where we can see hearing loss, but NMO is not one that's on my list. Mike, do you have experience with that?
We don't see a lot of hearing loss, but one of the things I'd just like to add to what you said about brain lesions is that a lot of people describe brain stem lesions as being part of the brain. And we do have a population of patients who do have brain stem lesions that could cause, say, double vision, nausea, vomiting. It can cause potentially hearing loss. So it's not out of the question, but it is a little bit unusual. And we just submitted a publication on 30 patients or so who do have these brain stem abnormalities, and the vast majority of them are African American in race, and that's something that we're trying to understand.
Great, thank you. And one more medication question for NMO. What about Cytoxan? Is it effective in preventing relapses in NMO? I mean, any of you can take it.
Mike, do you want to tackle that one first? I can jump.
So what I would say about Cytoxan is cyclophosphamide. It's a chemotherapy. It kills white blood cells. And in that respect, it is very effective. It suppresses the immune system. The problem with cyclophosphamide is the side effects and the consequences of that kind of severe type of immunosuppression. For some diseases, it's necessary to suppress the immune system to that degree. Cyclophosphamide is life-saving for some diseases, like rheumatologic diseases. In NMO, I think we can get away with being a little gentler. We can be a little bit more specific also in targeting different parts of the immune system rather than just blasting it with cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan.
Great. And we have had a Facebook question, which is sort of going back to the exercise conversation we were having. Diane talks about her 19-year-old daughter who got TM 4 years ago. She's a complete paraplegic from her belly button down. She's had intensive PT at Kennedy Krieger, has an FES bike. Is there hope for someone who is a complete paraplegic for recovery if they continue to work hard?
Yes. It's the simple answer.
Excellent.
We can say it multiple ways. You can say, absolutely, there is hope for recovery. You can also make the statement, and I think this is a true statement. Mike, I'm curious your thoughts. Without ongoing regular physical activity asking her body to recover, it is highly unlikely to happen spontaneously, that you stack the deck in your favor by maintaining that activity. And there are dramatic secondary benefits to the ongoing activity, even if the type of recovery we want didn't occur. There are other reasons that it needs to be maintained. But the short answer is absolutely there is hope.
I'll second that. I never put it past a patient to recover. The younger the better, but even older folks who've had lesions that landed them in a wheelchair for a year or two or more have made some pretty impressive recoveries, so I wouldn't put it past anything. And of course, in our lab, what we're trying to study and develop are stem cells and small molecule therapies to target this group of patients who've had such severe damage that they're not able to walk at all, and try to get them back some measure of neurologic function.
And would you want to comment some more about some of your stem cell research? I mean, we've had a couple of questions about what's the latest, any updates? And I know we have a symposium coming up, so you could share about that too.
Yeah, I always like talking about stem cells because I think it has a great potential for genuine regeneration and recovery of function. The idea behind transplanting stem cells into a damaged spinal cord is to really allow the electrical signal to get past the lesion and recover some function. Depending on what type of stem cells we use, we're trying to both remyelinate using stem cells that make myelin and to regenerate using stem cells that form these neuronal bridges to allow conduction of signal. So we're working with companies that have FDA-approved trials with stem cells so that we can try to expedite this into TM. One thing that we have to contend with in TM that's a little bit different from other diseases is that a lot of our patients have autoimmune diseases and other immunologic problems, and the FDA is concerned that when we transplant a stem cell into a patient's spinal cord, that it'll trigger another attack of TM. So we're working on trying to find the right immunosuppression regimen for a trial and, consider the long-term consequences of having stem cell transplant in a patient who may react to it adversely. But we're working on that. I hope to have more updates at the symposium.
That's very exciting. Changing gears, there were a few questions on life expectancy, whether having TM or NMO will shorten life expectancy, and do residual effects, if you've had an attack, say when you were very young, 8 years old, will they worsen with age?
Well, in general, we don't think of, if we just take the average individual, I'll talk about transverse myelitis first, as changing the life expectancy of an individual. And I couch that, though, based on a person's level of function. We do know that patients who are completely paralyzed and non-mobile have higher rates of infections or blood clots that form that can really impact health and that can be potentially fatal. And so we worry about complications from lack of mobility, but the disease itself, the direct damage to the spinal cord, does not change life expectancy. In neuromyelitis optica, we've known for a long time that untreated neuromyelitis optica would shorten a life expectancy, but via the same way, by repetitive attacks on the spinal cord leading to extreme disability and then a blood clot or an infection occurring. And in the absence of that, neuromyelitis optica does not kill people. It's attacks that lead to disability. Now we're moving into a world, though, where in order to prevent the attacks, we're using the medications that Michael described so well, rituximab and others. And our goal is to find medications that can be used for the long run safely that would not expose people to excessive risk of infections or other complications. So in general, the answer is no, but there are some unique situations where if somebody has a significant amount of disability, they're able to move about the world, can lead to severe complications.
Thank you. What about bladder recovery? You know, what are the chances of recovery of bladder dysfunction and autonomic functions after a transverse myelitis attack? Can that recovery happen, Dr. Levy?
Yeah, you know, it really depends. The autonomic functions, things like sweating and heart rate and blood pressure, I've seen those recover a lot faster than bladder function. I think it's because there are other compensatory mechanisms that can handle those functions. Bladder is a little bit more complicated and tends to recover somewhat over time, but tends to remain a problem in a lot of my patients. We work closely with urologists who have medications and other tools to help with daily function, bladder and bowel, try to keep everything regular and not cause problems. But as far as strict neurologic recovery, it can tend to persist over time. But like I said, there is some degree of recovery that occurs.
And does surgery or medication help recovery, or does it just help with symptom management?
I think it helps with symptom management, and that can really make a big difference. We've had some people whose bladder dysfunction was so bad it really disabled them, kept them from working, and then when we came up with a solution, it didn't necessarily fix the neurologic problem, but it helped her cope, and she mm-hmm. was able to get back to work. So I acknowledge it is a major problem, but there are many different treatments available.
And I'm going to get to a difficult set of questions, and they're all focused on pain. And this is something a lot of people struggle with. You know, some struggle with no pain in the beginning, and then after not having had any pain for years, suddenly have neuropathic pain. Do you have overall thoughts on pain and pain management? Dr. Greenberg, shall we start with you?
So my thoughts on pain and pain management are that it's a big issue. It's one that leads to a lot of collateral issues, and really working to find the safest ways to control the pain is important for a lot of reasons. People who are in pain don't function as well. They have worse sleep. They have less energy. Their other symptoms tend to be worse, and it really just takes a toll on people over time and has to be a priority after events like transverse myelitis. One of the critical issues in pain management is understanding that we think some medicines work better than others. In general, for neuropathic pain, we tend to avoid opiates and narcotics because we have data to say they don't work as well as some other approaches. But we also have the experience to know that no two patients are alike. Individualization of a treatment plan to a patient is important and often requires some trial and error. Patients will commonly have to move through several different drugs to try and find a combination or dose that works well for them. So there has to be a commitment from the patient and from the treating physician to, in a methodical way, sort through what drugs are working and what aren't. And in extreme situations, sometimes we have to move to interventions or medications that are delivered via a pump directly into the spinal fluid to get pain relief. But we tend to do that as a last resort after we've exhausted other options.
But does the effectiveness of these drugs decrease over time?
Not always. There are definitely some patients who indicate that after a long period of time on a drug, it seems to be wearing off, and bodies can become used to a certain drug being in their system. With some drugs, it's more common than others. The most common is with opiates. There is a well-documented phenomenon called tachyphylaxis, where you keep requiring higher and higher doses in order to get the same pain relief. And so in the opiate world, it's actually expected that that's what can happen. With some of the other drugs, it's less clear. We definitely keep our mind open to it and sometimes have to come up with a strategy of alternating between drugs over time to give a body a break from different medications.
And is there any correlation between pain and neuro recovery? So if someone's not had pain for a long time and then they have new pain symptoms, is that a signal for anything?
I sometimes am encouraged when a patient has, initially no sensory function at all, can't feel a thing, and then they tell me that they have pain in that area, because to me, I consider that not necessarily a good thing for the patient to experience, but at least a sign that there's neurologic recovery, that there's some signal that could potentially be getting to the brain. So sometimes if I touch the patient's leg that was previously insensate and then they tell me they could feel that, but it's painful, well, I don't want them to experience pain, but I'm encouraged that there's some neurologic function that's coming from that leg and sensory function. So it's sort of a good thing in that there's new function recovery, but it's a bad thing because it often keeps them from participating in physical therapy if they have some motor function there. And it can just be hard to go to sleep at night and so on. And so for those patients, I do generally treat the pain, but again, I reassure them that it doesn't necessarily mean anything is getting worse. It could actually mean that things are getting better.
It's great. There's a question from Carol in Chicago. Cytoflavin has been investigated successfully used in Russia for use in treating all kinds of spinal brain injuries. It has four components, inosine, succinic acid, nicotinamide, and riboflavin. It's not available in the U.S., and she would love to hear your thoughts if you're aware of this drug for use in spinal and brain injuries.
Mike, is this something you're aware of?
I am not. I'm looking it up now, though.
Yeah, and I think this is actually a good example. It's not something I'm familiar with, so for mm-hmm. Carol's purposes, I can't specifically comment on this agent. There are hundreds of, probably even thousands of products advertised online or by friends or word of mouth or YouTube videos that make very dramatic claims relative to impact on neurologic function. And some of them are vitamins, supplements, some of them are agents that are hard to classify. And in general, what I tell patients is that at least in my practice, if you're established with a neurologist or you're seeing us and we're able to track, that as long as we know what you're taking, I keep a very open mind about these agents. We don't know what does and doesn't work. I don't claim to have a monopoly on the knowledge of what's going to lead to repair. But I often or always caution significant caution about taking things that have not been tested. There are unforeseen effects, and I'll cite one example. Years ago, there was a big belief, and it still is even out there, that antioxidants are great for you. And mainly in the world of cancer, that you need more antioxidants to fight cancer. And beta-carotene is a big antioxidant, and people would come in saying, oh, I was told, or I heard, or I read, or my aunt said, I need to take more beta-carotene. And people would swear, absolutely swear, that it cured their cancer, saved them, and did well. Well, finally, there was a very well done, very well controlled trial of beta carotene for treating cancer, and more people who took beta carotene died and died sooner than people who weren't taking it. And so the reason we do the studies we do are because we have to keep an open mind that in the absence of controlled studies, there was always a chance that what we think is working a certain way, we could be surprised by. And what seems to be an innocuous supplement could end up doing harm. And so in general, I just remind people of the fact that they need to be careful, but most importantly, as their treating physician, I want to know what they're taking so I can at least keep track. So relative to this product, I can't comment. We do know that some vitamins like riboflavin have been used in a variety of different conditions and seem to have a very good safety profile, but it's hard to speak authoritatively.
Thank you for answering that. I know that was a difficult one. So in the last few minutes that we have remaining, I would sort of like to open it up to both of you to spend a few minutes talking about the latest research. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share? And Dr. Greenberg, if you'd share about the symposium in Dallas on October 25th, 26th with our listeners, that would be great.
Sure, I can fire the first shot and then turn things over to Mike to close. So first, the symposium, October 25th and 26th here in Dallas, Texas. It should have cooled off by then, so it won't be as hot, giving everybody an Uthoff's phenomenon when they come, is a Transverse Myelitis Association-sponsored event for patients, families, and clinicians to come and focus on recovery and repair after one of these events. In years past, Symposium has focused on updating people relative to how do we diagnose, how do we treat the acute attack, how do we manage symptoms. And this year, with a lot of feedback from our community, we decided to focus completely on recovery and repair. You've had an event. How do you get better? And the Symposium is going to have several blocks of topics. One is recovery through rehabilitation, which you can do right now. You do not need any new science. You do not need a new drug. It is available to you today. Move to drugs that are available on the market that can help improve function. Move to drugs that are coming down the pipeline to help repair damage that's been done. And finally, ending the symposium with discussions about stem cell therapy, and Mike will be integral to that conversation. And we think it's going to be a great opportunity to come and learn about what's available to you for recovery and to meet other patients and families within this rare disease community. Because it's extremely important to recognize that even with a rare disease, you're not alone, that there are lots of people across the country and indeed across the world who are going through the exact same experience as you are, and having that connection to others actually goes a long way to helping people mentally and emotionally deal with the challenges that our patients deal with every single day after events like this. I personally would argue that the future for these diseases is quite bright. We've seen new opportunities of funding for research in rare diseases. The Transverse Myelitis Association, Hopkins, and UT Southwestern, as well as colleagues in Philadelphia and Toronto, were a recent recipient of a large-scale study of outcomes in pediatric transverse myelitis. This is a large 3-year grant to allow us to get smarter about what happens when we treat patients and refine what those treatments are. And Sandy Siegel sent me an email the other day, and I think he's right that this is the first large federally funded transverse myelitis study in history. It's nice to see that the attention is being paid to these conditions so that we can start to have better answers the next time we do a podcast like this and be able to say, I don't know less, and give more facts. So I think things are going the right direction. It's never fast enough, but we're going the right direction.
Thank you, Dr. Greenberg. Dr. Levy, any closing thoughts from you?
Yeah, so one thing that I would really like to emphasize is that the first stem cell trials in humans have only started since 2010. And there are already three studies ongoing, and it's really just the beginning. Companies are really getting into this field because the FDA has allowed new research into it, and they realize that there's a lot of potential, that patients have many options to prevent their disease using these many drugs that we have, but for patients who've already sustained a spinal cord injury, there really aren't a lot of biological agents to improve healing. And the field is very unmet, and companies are really beginning to jump in. There is a study that has just started in multiple sclerosis for patients who have lesions to try to remyelinate those lesions. And hopefully we'll be going into TM trials soon. In our lab, we work with several companies that have pulled out compounds from their closets that they never really considered before, but they've recently found that they could be useful in remyelinating patients with spinal cord disease. And so we're testing those in animal models. And so what I'd really like to emphasize is that it's just the beginning. Companies are really interested in this. Academicians are interested in this. Patients have always been interested in it, but now our incentives are aligned. And I think that there is a lot of potential to move these things forward in the near future. As Ben said, we do have to be patient, but it's a very exciting field to be in right now.
Thank you both very much. We really appreciate your time. I know we didn't get to a lot of questions, but I hope we can respond to them via social media, emails, and perhaps another podcast. And for those who are able to attend the symposium in Dallas, perhaps you can ask these questions directly of both Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Levy, who will be with us. Once again, thank you for your commitment to our community, your support, passion in studying these diseases. We greatly appreciate both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.